This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now watch Uprising on Free Speech TV, which airs on Dish Network Channel 9415, DirecTV Channel 348, and on hundreds of part-time cable affiliates and on Roku. Two major corporations, McDonald's and Costco, have just announced that they will no longer distribute chicken that has been treated with antibiotics. The companies are responding to a growing awareness of the overuse of antibiotics and its links to ill health. Not only are animals in the conventional meat industry routinely treated with drugs to increase yields, doctors have for years overprescribed antibiotics to treat illnesses, many of which don't even benefit from the drugs. Retailers have flooded the market with antibacterial soaps, cleaners, and more, playing to our collective germophobia. To be clear, there are lethal bacteria that can and do kill us and need to be eliminated. But the reality is that for much of human history, we have coexisted with bacteria and have evolved to need germs in our bodies and our environments. Cutting-edge science is increasingly proving that stripping ourselves of bacteria can lead to the rise of antibiotic-resistant superbugs. And it can also make us, as individuals, develop a host of familiar modern diseases. We turn today to Dr. Martin Blaser. He is the director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. He has studied the role of bacteria in human disease for over 30 years. He's the author of the highly reviewed and acclaimed book, Missing Microbes: How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues, which was released last year to wide acclaim and which is just now out in paperback. Welcome to Uprising, Martin Blaser.
My pleasure to be here.
Before we get to the effects or the sort of unintended negative effects of antibiotics, can you explain how important microbes themselves are to our human body? I think many of us still don't appreciate that we are literally crawling inside and outside with millions, billions, trillions of these invisible living creatures. How much of our bodies do they inhabit and what do they help us do?
Most of the human body is microbial cells. Bacteria, fungi, protozoa, there are also viruses. Those cells outnumber our human cells. And the point is that they are ancient. We have had, ever since there have been animals on this planet, which is more than 500 million years, they've had residential organisms calling them home. And we're no different.
Now, so let's talk about the antibiotics itself, which when we take, we kill microbes. Sometimes we kill bad microbes or pathogens that can hurt us, but often we end up with a sort of scorched earth approach that where we're killing off too many microbes or the wrong ones. What happens when our microbes get killed? What sort of ill effects can they have on our bodies?
Well, let me just go back a little and say that when a person takes an antibiotic, whether they take it by mouth or intravenously, that antibiotic gets into the bloodstream and it goes to every part of the body. And whenever there are residential microbes, the microbes that call us home, that antibiotic is working. And it's suppressing certain organisms and it allows other organisms to grow up. So if you have a cut, an infected cut on your hand, that antibiotic is working there, but it's also working throughout your body. And it's this collateral effect is something that we're very concerned about.
And of course, we should certainly establish, I think, the history, at least for those of us who don't remember or don't know enough about the history of life before antibiotics, right? And I think one of the things that I was quite impressed by your book was that you make it really clear that antibiotics and their advent were a medical revolution that helped save and have helped save millions of lives. Can you give us that brief history of how antibiotics revolutionized medicine?
Yeah, you know, most of us attribute the rise of antibiotics to Fleming's discovery of penicillin in 1928. But it wasn't until the 1940s that antibiotics really began to be used. And they began to be used in World War II, and they saved thousands of lives of soldiers who had infected wounds. And it became immediately clear that antibiotics could be life-saving in people who had life-threatening infections. And as a result, they were used to help people go through surgery, to have organ transplantation, chemotherapy. None of those could exist without the umbrella of antibiotics to protect people during those downtimes and those down cycles. So antibiotics are miraculous drugs. They are the underpinning of medicine. But we doctors have been using them more and more and more. And so it's now considered that some fraction of antibiotics, 60% of antibiotics, in some studies 80% of antibiotics, are unnecessary.
So has there has this notion in the medical establishment that is thankfully changing today, but this prevalent notion that there's no downside to antibiotics, that we can prescribe them just in case, has that led to the overuse today?
Yeah, very much so. I'm a medical doctor. When I went to school and when two or three generations of doctors went to school, we learned that antibiotics had a few uncommon toxicities, but mostly they were safe. And that's why they're so wonderful, because you can safely treat so many important infections. But now that we begin to study it, we see that there can be long-term consequences. It was always assumed that you would take an antibiotic, things would be perturbed for a while, and then everything would bounce back to normal. That's what we all thought. The doctors thought it, the public thought it, but it's becoming clear that that's not quite true.
And how much of the blame for the prevalence and overuse of antibiotics can be laid at the feet of pharmaceutical companies that have relied and heavily invested in the so-called broad spectrum antibiotics? So basically enabling doctors to be able to prescribe drugs that can, you know, just a handful of drugs can have effects on a wide range of maladies. And so instead of having a narrow focused approach, we're basically killing an ant with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, you know, it's everybody's fault. We can fault the pharmaceutical companies, we can fault the doctors and the dentists and everybody who's using antibiotics, we can fault the public because everybody thought it was free. But in essence, it's kind of nobody's fault. This kind of ran away from us because we thought it was free. You know, if something's free, you want to use it. And if I'm a doctor and I think there's not going to be any problem and that a patient could potentially benefit from it, then I'll say, why not? Because it's free. But once we begin to understand that it's not free, now we have to recalculate things.
Right.
And the pharmaceutical companies were developing broad spectrum antibiotics because that's what we want. When a patient comes in with pneumonia, we don't know what they have. So we treat them with a broad spectrum antibiotic, which will cover most of the bases. But even now, we can start to narrow it down. And one of the things I call for in Missing Microbes is that we have to develop a whole new generation of antibiotics, narrow spectrum antibiotics, that will just target the agent causing the infection and not cause all this collateral damage.
And also have much faster turnaround time for the tests that doctors do, right? Because how can they determine what drugs, specific drugs to give us, unless they can get the results of testing of our bodily fluids within hours?
Right. So we need those rapid diagnostic tests. Now,
yeah,
it turns out that a lot of tests exist right now, but the whole economics of the visit,
right,
to the doctor for antibiotics is just all wrong. We're relying on relatively inexpensive antibiotics, but ultimately the cost to us is much, much greater because of the damage they're doing, especially to our children.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought up children. That was my next question. You make the case in your book that an increasing over-reliance on C-sections in childbirth has had a serious impact on the microbiomes of babies. And this was something that I just didn't really realize that in women's bodies, most of our bodies have microbes, but our wombs are essentially sterile. We don't have microbes in our wombs. And when babies are born, they're colonized in the first moments of their life by microbes from the mother. But generally, they're colonized when there's vaginal deliveries. When there's C-section, what happens to babies?
Well, as you said, in the womb, the baby is sterile or almost sterile. And then when the water breaks, that's where they have their first introduction to the world of bacteria. And when they pass out through the birth canal, they're covered with their mom's bacteria. We humans are mammals, and this is how mammals have been doing it for 100 million years. But C-sections, those babies don't get that initial exposure. Now, there are very important reasons to do C-sections. It's like antibiotics. There are important reasons when it's life-saving, but the rates of C-section have gone up and up and up. So today, one-third of all babies born in the United States are born by C-section. And in some countries, it's half the babies are born by C-section. They're all missing that normal initial inoculum.
And it's the first 3 years of a baby's life that they acquire the majority of microbes that then they live with for the rest of their lives. So what impact can that have on children? And what are some of the diseases that you, through your experiments and your lab and your colleagues, through your experiments on mice, think might be linked to missing microbes in the first 3 years of babies' lives?
Well, you stated it really quite well. So during those 3 years when the microbiome is developing, that's when babies are developing. They're developing their immunity, their metabolism, their cognition, their brain function. And so if they're developing their microbiome aberrantly or incorrectly because of C-sections and antibiotics and formula feeding and many other factors that are all cumulative, then there's the theoretical possibility that it's affecting their metabolic development, that it may make them more prone to obesity and diabetes, and their immunologic development more prone to asthma and allergies. And we and others have been finding evidence that this is correct, and that this, in fact, is a factor that was unrecognized before, but which is fueling these epidemics of these modern plagues.
It's amazing. You know, when I had my children in the hospital, one of the first things that they do to babies when they're born is that they give them a vitamin K shot. And vitamin K is an interesting thing that's produced, I understand, by bacteria in our body. But they also smear their eyes with erythromycin, an antibiotic, just in case they might get infected with gonorrhea, whether or not the mother has gonorrhea. I mean, so we do this to babies within the first few minutes of their lives?
So again, everybody thinks there's no cost to that. So each of the 4 million babies born in the United States is getting those antibiotics in their eye drops. The eye disease due to gonorrhea in babies was a terrible disease before there was antibiotics. Now it can be treated. And the number of potential cases is probably low. It's in the hundreds, but we're treating the millions. In many countries in Europe, they don't treat babies with antibiotics, and they seem to be doing fine. There's no epidemic of child blindness. So again, we're using it thinking that it's free, but I think that all these things are cumulative.
So when babies, through their first years of their lives, establish their microbiome, their colonies of bacteria, how does that develop differently in babies in the Western world versus in the non-industrialized world? The science has shown that there are different species and different varieties of microbes in countries where, for example, mothers pre-chew their foods as opposed to feeding jar food, or where the water supplies aren't as chlorinated as they are here.
If we compare the United States, a very industrialized, developed country for more than 100 years, with some countries in Africa or Latin America, there are huge differences. There are many different kinds of differences. You've named a few of them, but there are even more. But what we can say is that their microbes are different, substantially different. And the point that I want to discuss the most is that their microbes are more diverse than ours. Ecologists think that diversity is very important for health. And there's increasing evidence that we in the United States and other developed countries are losing diversity. And that can have important consequences for health. That's still theoretical, but there is more and more information that we have lost diversity. And now the question is, does that have a direct consequence or not?
Let's talk about the use of antibiotics in livestock. I used to think that factory farms administered antibiotics because of the horrible, crowded conditions that they raised animals in to just fend off disease. But through reading your book, I realized that they just administer them continuously at low levels because antibiotics just basically cause animals to gain weight, so there's a profit incentive. Whether or not we understand clearly why that happens, the agribusinesses know that it happens, and so they're putting these in at least conventional foods. And does that then get passed on to us? And if so, wouldn't it have the same effect in our bodies as it does in animals' bodies?
Well, your points are all good. Farmers and agricultural scientists have known for 70 years that if they put low doses of antibiotics into the food or water of livestock, they will gain weight faster. It's what they call growth promotion. And the reason that they do it is because it works. And as a result, 70 to 80% of all the antibiotics used in the United States are used on the farm specifically for growth promotion. It is not used to treat disease because they're not even using therapeutic doses. They're using sub-therapeutic doses. Now, some of that antibiotic gets into our foods. There have been surveys in the supermarket that some meats have residuals of the antibiotics. Milk may have antibiotic. And in some communities, their drinking water has antibiotics. Now, the levels are low, but millions of people are being exposed, and no one has ever studied what the consequences are. We don't know what they are, but we need to know.
And the FDA has just a couple of years ago finally come out and said this is a serious problem they need to do something about. But in Europe, it's been banned for years. Is there? Do you have a good sense that the FDA is going to start to ban these? Because we're probably, you know, animals are probably losing microbes as well, and overall, ecologically, that can have an impact.
This is one of the reasons I wrote Missing Microbes, to inform the public about all these issues, because it will take political muscle to change these. The farmers are very much interested in this because it increases their profit margin. But I was pleased to see that last week McDonald's said they're phasing out chickens raised with antibiotics. And a few years ago, Tyson Farms said that they were going to do it. And so it's coming along. The FDA's is taking baby steps. I hope they are steps in the right direction, because we need to do it. We are squandering our legacy of antibiotics, including the development of resistance on the farm, to save a few pennies on meat, plus the fact that the antibiotics are coming over to us because not all the farmers are ethical. They're still keeping them on antibiotics. There's supposed to be a washout period before they go to market, and obviously that's being violated at some times.
There was just a report on milk and residual antibiotics being found in milk. And in fact, some farmers giving antibiotics that are not tested for to slip them in. Let's turn to you mentioned resistance, and that's one of the huge concerns for our modern society. We've seen the rise of these deadly pathogens that don't respond to antibiotics. MRSA is one, M-R-S-A, known by its acronym. Recently, there was an outbreak at UCLA Medical Center of superbug. Can you explain for our audience how it works? How does the overuse of antibiotics actually give rise to bacteria that don't respond to antibiotics?
Well, what antibiotics do is that they suppress or kill bacteria. That's what they're chemicals that do this. And they don't differentiate between whether the bacteria are good or bad. They're just whether they're susceptible or not. So if you take antibiotics, they will kill the susceptible ones, and that allows resistant ones to rise up. And of course, we're doing this on an enormous scale on the farm. And so resistant organisms are rising up on the farm, and they're coming to over to humans via food. Now, it's also happening in the hospitals because of our use of antibiotics. So the more we use antibiotics, the more we promote resistance. There are very important times to use antibiotics. I want to be very clear about that. Mm-hmm. There are times when antibiotics are life-saving, and the issue of resistance doesn't come into it's a trivial. But because of the overuse of antibiotics, that's also fueling resistance. So one of the best ways to get this resistance problem under control is to minimize antibiotic use, save it for the times we really need to. Now, this is a decision of doctors, because in the United States, you need a prescription to get antibiotics. But sometimes patients lean on the doctors, and they feel disappointed if the doctor doesn't give them an antibiotic. And as I say in Missing Microbes, if the doctor has done a careful exam and says you or your child doesn't need an antibiotic, you should be happy that you don't have a serious infection, mm-hmm. not feel that you need the antibiotic, because the antibiotic has cost. And if it's not going to have any benefit, you don't need it.
So, Dr. Blaser, let's talk a little bit about the complexity and how we're just understanding how microbes function in our body. A lot of your research has focused on a particular microbe called H. pylori, which scientists had years ago linked to ulcers, and which became this universally reviled microbe. And you describe in your book, essentially, the only good H. pylori microbe is a dead one, which has been the sort of approach. But your work has revealed that under some circumstances, H. pylori is necessary for us, and in other circumstances, it can cause things like ulcers and cancers. How does that fit within the context of what we know about microbiology today, and how microbes work in concert with one another?
Yeah, I think H. pylori is kind of a poster child, initially discovered as a pathogen, and it's a serious pathogen causing ulcers and causing stomach cancer, which is worldwide the number two cause of cancer death. I was very much involved in those studies.
Yeah.
And those are problems that mostly occur late in life. And I began to think, you know, Helicobacter pylori has been present in humans for at least 200,000 years, probably for millions of years, and perhaps it has some benefits. And once we started looking for it, we found the benefits. You know that there's an epidemic all over the Western world of reflux esophagitis, or what's called GERD, or reflux, or heartburn. That's been going up dramatically in recent decades, just when Helicobacter seems to be disappearing. And we and others, there are more than 50 papers now showing evidence that Helicobacter protects the esophagus. So we can say that Helicobacter is bad for your stomach, but it's good for your esophagus. And we and others have done studies to show that Helicobacter may be good for your lungs. Kids without Helicobacter are more likely to develop asthma. And studies in mice have confirmed this. So we're seeing a complex biological relationship with this organism that calls us home. Good for our esophagus and our lungs, bad for our stomach. 15 years ago, I suggested that we should be giving our kids H. pylori, and then at a certain age, get rid of it with antibiotics, and then we could optimize health. That's going to take a long time to turn that wheel around, and maybe we'll find better substitutes. But that could be an approach.
Well, let's talk about some of the cutting edge research that's being done on how we can start to deal with the ill effects of antibiotics. You write in your book about the discovery some years ago of an indigenous community in Venezuela that had really had very little contact with the outside world, and they were kind enough to share their specimens with scientists who found an incredible diversity of microbes. And as we were talking about in non-industrialized countries, there's just a greater diversity compared to those of us in the Western world. What have we lost and can it be replaced? What have we lost in terms of our microbial diversity? And can we see what isolated communities have that we don't have, maybe use that to replace what we've lost?
Well, you've read the book so carefully.
I have to say, I couldn't stop reading it. I started reading it on Friday, and I couldn't stop reading it till yesterday. So it's fascinating.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, I'm very pleased to say that the study in Venezuela has just been accepted for publication. It's going to be in a journal called Science Advances. I think it's going to come out this month or next month. The study was led by Maria Gloria Dominguez Bello, who happens to be my wife, as I point out in the book. As you say, it shows that this group of people who have not been contacted by Westerners before, so they're living basically a Stone Age existence. They have so much more diversity in their skin, in their gut, than we do. It implies that we have lost a lot. It also implies that people like that may be a reservoir for those lost strains. We may not be able to find them in the U.S., but we can find them in these other places. And maybe that's going to be the source of those future strains that we're going to give to children to replace the ones that they've lost as a result of modernization.
Let's also talk about some of the things that we can do personally in our day-to-day lives to stop this over-reliance on things that kill off bacteria, in addition to doctors slowly changing their approaches and maybe mothers-to-be trying to avoid elective C-sections. What about the substances that we find in our cleaning products? I mean, dishwashing liquid says it has antibacterial that kills, 99% of all germs. People are constantly rubbing these hand sanitizers on their hands. You go to the supermarket and now they give you wipes with antibacterial stuff on them. And I've watched people wiping their carts lest they be infected by the germs of the previous person who held the cart. Are those also detrimental? Do those also rid us of our good bacteria?
Well, it's never been exactly studied, but my fear is that they're doing us more harm than they're doing us good. When you apply these, they're killing bacteria, including your own good bacteria. And the good bacteria help protect us against the bad bacteria. So you ask practical things. There are studies that show that taking antibiotics during pregnancy increases risk for certain diseases in the baby later. So antibiotics should only be used when necessary. C-section should be done only when necessary. Babies should be fed by the breast and not be fed formula unless it's impossible to do that, because the formula just superficially resembles breast milk. Breast milk is full of compounds designed for healthy bacteria. So breast milk in, formula out. Kids should only get antibiotics when they absolutely need them. In countries in Europe, there's huge variation in how often kids get antibiotics. And in studies here in the United States, we see that variation. So we have to decrease all these kinds of exposures. It turns out that a lot of foods have antibacterials in the foods. They were put in the foods to increase the shelf life of the foods, to protect them against bacteria. But these antibacterials, we're taking them in. We don't know the full effect of those. There was just a paper published about some of the emulsifiers used in foods that have antibacterial effects.
These are so processed foods in particular.
Yeah. So our microbiota is under onslaught, and therefore it's no surprise that our diversity has gone down. So we have to be aware of all of these, and we have to understand what are the consequences. Are there times when it's absolutely necessary? Are there times when we should do alternative things?
And actually, there's this one sort of growing trend among parents in the Western world who are concerned about this. And I'm wondering if you can set the record straight. I mean, people think that maybe if they let their kids eat dirt or play more in the dirt and not wash their hands as much, that'll help restore their microbiology. Is that true?
Well, there are many people who think it's true. I think it's irrelevant.
Okay.
Because the microbes in dirt are evolved for soil. They're not evolved for human beings. And when you take them in, they won't last in your system very long. The home bacteria will throw them out. What is important are the microbes that we humans have had for millennia, for hundreds of thousands of years, that we're losing. Those are the most important ones. We have to figure out how to stop the damage and how to start replacing them.
Well, finally, Dr. Blazer, I know this may sound utterly revolting to our audience, but I have to ask you, and you write about this new book, there have been a lot of promising experiments showing that fecal transplants between people who have a healthy gut bacteria and those who don't has actually found to have excellent results. And of course, there's a serious ick factor here. There's even some instances of do-it-yourself at home anecdotes, which I'm sure you're not advising people. But can you tell us if this is a promising avenue of gross but possible possibly effective treatment for a host of problems?
Yeah, well, there's a very serious infection due to a bacterium. It's called Clostridium difficile infection, or C. diff. It's an infection that often comes about in people who've had antibiotics, and it can be a very severe disease. In fact, thousands of people die from it every year in the United States. Very bad disease, and it's been found that taking a fecal transplant, a fecal specimen from a healthy person, basically cures these people. There was a controlled clinical trial in the Netherlands a few years ago. They had to stop the trial because the fecal transplant works so much better than the conventional therapy. And that's become really one of the leading therapies for that particular infection. Now, there are lots of people who are trying to extrapolate from that and say, well, if it's good for that, it's good for something else. But none of those have been tested.
Right.
And I do not recommend it except in the context of a clinical trial. Then we will discover for what ailments will it work and for which ones will it not work, and expose people to unnecessary risk.
And finally, do you have an opinion on the probiotic supplements that are all over the health food shelves, but also the increased resurgence in fermented foods?
Well, I love yogurt. I eat yogurt every day. I have for decades, but I eat it because it's delicious. And I vaguely think it's healthy for me, but that's plain yogurt. In terms of probiotics, you go to the health food store, the grocery store, the pharmacy. There are hundreds of products. They're all labeled probiotic. What I can say is that they are generally, but not completely, safe, and they are almost entirely untested. So I don't know what they do.
Yeah.
In fact, nobody knows what they do. And the people who sell them make lots of extravagant claims, and there are many people who buy them. That's why there are so many of these products. But they also need to be tested so we can understand which were the ones that work and which are the ones that don't.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending the time to explain this very important issue to us. Thank you so much.
And thank you for your careful reading of Missing Microbes.
Thank you,
Thank
Dr.
you.
Martin Blaser has been my guest. He's director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. He studied the role of bacteria in human disease for over 30 years. He's the author of the highly reviewed and acclaimed book that we've been discussing, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. It was just released last year to wide acclaim and out last month in paperback. This is Uprising.